Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, last week, the 2019 Nobel Prize for Physics was given to Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz, who were given the award for their discovery of the first exoplanet orbiting a solar-type star. That discovery was made in 1995 at the Observatoire de Haute-Provence and was the first of thousands. And the search continues to this day. And among those on the lookout for new worlds is my next guest. She is Dr. Emma Whelan from the Department of Experimental Physics in Maynooth. And she joins us now on the line from the place where it all began, that observatoire in Haute-Provence. Hi, Emma. How are you?
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for talking to me. How are you?
I'm very good. For those of us who may not be familiar with the term exoplanets, what is an exoplanet?
It's just a planet that's been found outside our own solar system. So we have eight planets in our solar system. And then the exoplanet is anything orbiting around another star.
And your work sort of centered around the sort of jets that stars launch. Can you tell us a little bit about early formation and your work?
Yeah, so the story of star formation, I guess, it's the story of how our own home formed, how our own solar system formed. And a jet is something that occurs as a young star is forming. So a star forms in a molecular cloud. There's lots of molecular clouds within our own galaxy. And they're quite clumpy, though. And so what happens is that one part, little clump within the molecular cloud, it's initially stable against gravity. But for different reasons, many of which we don't understand yet, it becomes gravitationally unstable and it begins to collapse.
When you say a molecular cloud, do you mean just sort of bits of debris in space?
Yeah, so it's just a big cloud of gas and dust, and they're the coldest places in the universe, and they make up what we call the interstellar medium, so what we see out in space. And they retain two things from the molecular cloud in which they're forming, a magnetic field and an angular momentum, so they're rotating. And so what you get is an envelope of material infalling onto the center where it's very dense, and that's where the star is forming. But because of the rotation, you get a disk, and the disk is where the planets will eventually form after this, you know, towards the end of the formation of the star. And because there's infalling material and everything is rotating, and we get jets launched. So they're just collimated outflows of plasma and some dust. And what we think they do is that they remove some of this angular momentum from the system. Otherwise, the star forming at the center would be rotating too rapidly and would never form properly. So this is why jets are important.
I thought these planets came from exploding stars.
So when a star goes supernova, you're left with a neutron star and a pulsar. And there have been some planets detected around them, but they're not planets like we think of in our own solar system. So what happens is that as the star forms and it evolves, gets towards the end of its formation stage, this disk in which it has formed from, which surrounds the star, a circumstellar disk, begins to evolve and the planets form within that disk. And we can see that in our own solar system. So we see we have terrestrial planets, the rocky planets, we have the gaseous planets, and then we have regions called the Kuiper Belt, regions where we find trans-Neptunian objects. And they're what's left over of the disk from which our star formed. And then we have this region where we think comets come from, the Oort cloud, and that's left over from the cloud from which our solar system formed. You know, there's lots of evidence that this model we've developed for star formation is how our own solar system formed. That it's correct. We only have to look at our own solar system to see evidence of this.
Right. And so as this clumps together, those clumps eventually become planets.
So there's different mechanisms depending on the type of planet we're forming. So the disk is dusty, and all of these dust grains start to stick together and they form bigger and bigger clumps of material. Eventually they form what we call planetesimals. And when they get to planetesimal size, they start colliding with each other and they clump together. And this is how the rocky planets formed. But then further out in the disk, we get the gaseous planets forming, and they form beyond what we call a region called the frost line. And in our own solar system, this is a region between Jupiter and Mars, beyond which important materials, important compounds can stay in an icy form. They're far enough away from the sun for this to happen. And because of this, and because of other conditions in this part of the disk, the gaseous planets were able to grow. They started off with a rocky core, like the planets close to the sun, like the terrestrial planets, but they were able to get these big gaseous atmospheres as well and grow to the size of Jupiter and Saturn.
Right, I see. And how do we know all this? How do you go about studying an exoplanet?
We know a lot of this from studying our own solar system, but we're really only at the stage where we're detecting exoplanets. But what we can do then is we can, from the different methods that we have, we can infer their mass, we can infer their radius, their density. We can look at where they're, you know, where they're, what their orbit is like and where they're orbiting with respect to their parent star. And then we can begin to develop models for how they form. And we're starting as well to be able to characterize, to be able to look at their atmospheres to see what their atmospheres could be made of. So all of this gives us evidence to feed into these planet formation models.
So how do we go about detecting these planets? And what was the method by which Mayor and Kilo's discovered that first exoplanet?
They used a method called the radial velocity method, or it's also known as the Doppler method. So basically we look, everything is moving with respect to us. It has a speed and we measured the speed of a star and we see that it's changing slightly and it's changing periodically. And we know that this is because of the planet orbiting around it. It's the gravity of the planet is pulling slightly the star and it's causing it to wobble. So you can see this wobble as a change in the position of the star or as a change in its speed, in the rate at which it's moving with respect to us. And so if we measure this over time, we see that this periodic change in its speed, and this tells us that there's a planet there.
Right. So basically, if there was no planet there, there would be a consistent rate. But because that planet's there, it causes a slight wobble. And that comes to us as a shift in the light spectrum, right? Because of the change in speed, light, the way light comes back to us varies very slightly because of that wobble.
Yeah. So if the source of the light that we're studying is moving with respect to us, you get a shift in the wavelength of that light, and that's known as the Doppler shift. So that's exactly it. So we look at the spectrum of the star, we look at the emission lines from the star, and we know that they should have particular wavelengths. But when we get the spectrum, we see that the wavelengths are slightly shifted. So we know that this is due to the Doppler effect, and we can convert this change in wavelength to a velocity. And that's how we measure the radial velocity.
There's another way of detecting these exoplanets, isn't there? What is that method?
Yeah, so there's a few other ways, but the most common other method is the transit method. So the transit method is that we just observe the star, we observe the brightness of the star, and we see that the brightness dips slightly as the planet transits or crosses in front of the star. And actually, most of the exoplanets have been detected in this way. So it does have its limitations, though, the transit method, because the orbit of the exoplanet has to be perfectly aligned with the Earth in order for us to be able to see it.
Right, because if unless it passes right across the surface of the star, we've no chance of detecting it. So if it goes around the top and under the bottom, we won't see it.
Exactly.
There are new technologies coming on stream over the next number of years that will open up portions of the sky in a way that we've never had access to before. Can you tell us about some of those developments and what you think they might reveal?
So I suppose the next thing we really want to do with exoplanets is that we want to find planets like our own. So we want to find Earth-like planets. We want to find them within a region called a habitable zone. So it's a region at a distance from a star where we think liquid water can exist. And we want to look at their atmospheres. These are the next things that we want to do, but we don't have the technology yet for doing this. But things like the ESO, Extremely Large Telescope, and this is going to be a 30-meter class telescope that will be available to the astronomical community in a few years, and the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going to be launched in the next couple of years. These are huge advances in the technology available to us at the moment, and the key science goals of both these projects are to do these things related to exoplanets that I've mentioned. So to try to characterize their atmospheres and to try to detect planets that are like our own planet.
Why did you get interested in exoplanets in the first place, Emma?
So I did my PhD in star formation, and I was interested in jets. The research that I'm doing at Maynooth University, I'm looking at very young stars that still have jets or winds, as we say, but they may have begun the form the start of the planet formation process, or there may actually be planets already in the disk. And this is really exciting because it allows us to investigate the very earliest stages of planet formation. And to, you know, we can really get information then to try to understand how planets form and how our own solar system formed.
I know that if you're working in a very specific field and at a specific place associated with that field, and all of a sudden the Nobel Prize is awarded, there's a huge sense of excitement and energy that comes as a result of that sort of announcement. What was it like at the telescope, and what it was like for you to have this part of science recognized by a Nobel Prize?
Yeah, so it's the last couple of weeks have been very exciting because of this, and I give a talk about this in Maynooth on Monday night, and so coincidentally, you know, then just a couple of weeks before the prize gets announced, and it also coincided with our trip here to the Observatoire d'Haute-Provence. So we come every year with our Physics with Astrophysics students. We've been coming here for 15 years. Our students are in fourth year, and they're taking data for their final year thesis projects, and every year they get a tour of the telescope where you know, this discovery was made, and we teach them about the different methods that are used to detect exoplanets. And so this year now, for the first time, the staff were calling it, this is the telescope that has won the Nobel Prize. So it's a huge boost for anybody working in the area. The students are greatly excited about it, but also for this observatory. You know, this is quite an old observatory. It's been here since the late 1800s, and it's mostly used for teaching. There are many telescopes here, but the 1.9 meter that is now the telescope that won the Nobel Prize is still used for research into exoplanets. But it's a great boost, you know, for the observatory and for the future work that this telescope will do. So it's great. Very exciting. It's very exciting for us that we were coming here so shortly after the announcement of the Nobel Prize.
Well, Dr. Emma Whelan is from the Department of Experimental Physics at Maynooth University. Emma, thanks very much.
That's great. Thank you.